I want to thank you and welcome you to the second day of the Black Hat briefings. And I've got just a couple of announcements, and I've got a couple questions for you. One is, I was at the Pony Awards last night, so I know who won those, but I don't know who was found guilty or innocent at the hacker court last night. Did anybody see?
Innocent?
Yeah. Oh, excellent. Those prosecutors have all the cards, you know, so it's always nice when somebody's innocent. I've got some announcements also. We have some initial statistics coming in from the Wall of Sheep and from the Aruba guys that are monitoring the network. And first I'll give you some Aruba stats. We peaked out at 16.2 megabits a second every once in a while. And so far, since they've been watching, we've moved 240 gigs of traffic. And they've intercepted or protected 709 clients who are trying to connect to people who'd set up rogue access points with the SSID of Black Hat. And the way their system's set up, then they auto-DOS the any machine that comes up as SSID Black Hat. So if you want to see how that works, just change your SSID to Black Hat and see how long your machine stands up. And then it'll follow your MAC address and keep destroying you even if you change your SSID. So change your MAC address after you've done this. And then they also have noticed a bunch of attacks where people fire up their clients and they'll start announcing, you know, Bank of America, Tully's, Linksys, and they'll see who responds. And when they notice people doing this, they'll de-auth and desync those connections too. So they've noticed a bunch of those hotspot attacks. But other than that, it's been pretty tame. The Wall of Sheep have just now gotten to processing traffic from lunch yesterday. I mean, that's how backed up they are. And the things they're finding are the people on laptops are pretty secure. They haven't detected much clear text, clear protocol traffic. But they're finding tons of mobile devices. So I think what's happening is people are pulling out their phones and not realizing it. And they're connecting with or doing things with their mobile devices in clear text. And so far, they're up to 12 people from 12 countries, U.S., Japan, U.K., China, and some others that have gotten bitten by this. So I'd say pay attention more to your mobile devices. Looks like that's the weak spot right now. Okay, so a couple of things you guys need to do. You need to turn in some feedback forms for us so we can get better stuff for you. And if you've got that little passport card to go around to the sponsors, you want to turn that in by lunchtime. We're going to do the drawing for all the prizes at lunch. You can come back after lunch, check in near the registration area. We'll have all the winners posted. And if you have to leave or you miss it, don't worry. We'll contact you if you've left your contact details on the form. If you haven't and you don't stop by, then you're a loser. Okay. I want to introduce Andrew Cushman. I'm sure a lot of you guys, if you're familiar with security at Microsoft, you've seen Andrew in one form or another. He's currently the senior director of the MSRC and has been quite active in the space. A lot of the recent successes publicly for Microsoft, I like to kind of attribute to him and all of his supporters. Microsoft has been a fantastic supporter of Black Hat and is our diamond sponsor. Not only that, they're a sustaining sponsor. They help us out around the world. And you can imagine they've got a pretty big phone book. So it's pretty good for us. So I'd like to introduce Andrew, who will then introduce our keynote, Rod Beckstrom. Thank you. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks very much, Jeff. It is an honor to be a sponsor to we love the Black Hat Conference. This is the premier conference on the circuit. And this year, it's bigger and better than ever. I'm honored to be here today to introduce Rod Beckstrom. He is the director of the National Cybersecurity Center. This is a new component, a new component within the Department of Homeland Security. And, you know, I thought I had a hard job running the Security Response Center. It kind of pales in comparison, I think. Rod reports to Cabinet Secretary Chertoff, and he is dotted line to three other Cabinet members. So, you know, on a daily basis, I don't know what his morning looks like. Probably a little messier than mine. Rob has a very interesting background. He had started his first company at 24. That was after graduating from Stanford. you may notice that he doesn't look like a typical Govey. You know, I suggested that maybe he was a volunteer. Looks almost like that, yes. He's had a half dozen other companies that he's started. One of them that was quite interesting was Privada. He was the chairman, raised a lot of capital. This was the first company to do secure credit card transactions over the Internet. I did ask him whether it was ever hacked. He said no. It is no longer in business, though. It kind of went away when that bubble burst. So I would also highlight that he's the co-author of Starfish and the Spider. You may have seen that about centralized versus decentralized organizations. He didn't actually let me know what he was going to talk about today. He did mention that some of the topics are in his book, which is available outside at the bookseller. And I think I've gone on long enough. Rod, I'd like to welcome you. And let's give Rod a big hand.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you so much. Well, we're going to do our best. We'll see. Well, it's a little intimidating to be standing in front of 3,000 of the smartest people in this country and actually from around the world, and because there's so much brain power in this room, and that any of us individually standing up against that is quite a force. But one thing we can take comfort in is my own background in technology started in 1979 when I learned to program Fortran on paper cards. That how many people here did paper card programming on IBM 360s, other machines? All right. Some of us are still here. So it was really exciting for me when we got to move to the TTY. You know, I transferred from Oklahoma State to Stanford University, and I actually got a terminal, you know, and we could write Pascal and write code and have the response right there. We didn't have to wait in line for a machine to go read those cards and getting all dimpled and folded. But had a chance to work on some different technology issues. Many of them were in the financial realm of derivatives trading and how do you model these wacko complex instruments, and also risk management. How do you look at risk management across a firm? And technology was interesting to some of the professors at Stanford at the time, so we recruited two to help us out with the company. And one of them was Myron Scholes, who's done work on options pricing theory, and the other was Bill Sharp. And Bill had a quote that helps me feel a little more comfortable this morning. And Bill's quote was, he'd always say, Rod, just remember, all of us are smarter than any of us. And Bill took that to heart. Bill was the father of indexing and actually father of the capital asset pricing model, which allows us to look at valuing any asset in the world and relating it to its risk. But I think the notion of all of us are smarter than any of us is critical to the issues that we're looking at in cybersecurity. So what I'd like to do today, with your permission, is really look at some of the high-level concepts and issues. I'm only going to very briefly talk about some of what we're beginning to work on at the National Cybersecurity Center. And the reason for that is that we're new. We're a brand new government initiative, and we're just working on our initial plans right now. I've been here for just a little over 4 months, and we're stepping through the process. In fact, last week was a big week for us, because Congress just approved our new START, which means we actually really do exist and can get some funding. So, but I'd like to start off today with a simple question, and that is, what is better than one black hat? What's better than one black hat? I'm sorry?
A thousand.
Okay, well, why don't we start with three? I'd like to start with three in this photo right here. Okay, because I knew this is a black hat conference, so I went looking around for some nice black top hats. And I found this photo, okay? And actually, let me ask a question. How many people here are from the U.S.? How many of us are from the U.S., okay? And how many are from outside the U.S.? All right. So everyone in the U.S. knows who this gentleman is in the black hat, and probably most of you do internationally. This is President Abraham Lincoln. And this is a very important moment in history here. He's standing right near the battlefield in Antietam. And Antietam was the first battle fought in the North in the American Civil War. And either on this day or the day before or the day after was the bloodiest single day in American history, where 23,000 people died. It was the single deadliest day in American history on American soil. And this photo has a lot of meaning that relates to us in cyber today, so I'd like to step through some of that. So we see Lincoln here standing very gallantly. He's a very lanky man, very tall for his time, and he really liked the war scene. Now, the first thing we think about is, you know, was Lincoln a black hat or was Lincoln a white hat, right? You know, to me, Lincoln was a white hat because he led this open source community. There was this huge community, all right? It had about 12 million members, and it haggled over its code and over its framework. And the community had been in a huge dispute over membership that had gone on almost since the community was founded. And some people thought the membership in the open source community should be exclusive and that only certain people of a certain race should be allowed in. And other people thought that was absolutely wrong because they believed in certain lines from the Declaration of Independence that everyone should be a member of that open source community. And the community had a lot of debates and a lot of battles, and what happened? Right? The community could not come together. Okay? As a leader of the community, he tried to sit down with those that wanted to fork the code and exercise, and they thought the license on the code was like GPL, right? They thought, we have a right to fork, okay? We're not getting along with you. We can take the code. We'll go do it our way. We'll run the operating system on our own machines. We'll call those machines our states, Georgia or Virginia. We're going to run it our way. We're going to and we'll be fine. And Lincoln said no. As the leader of the community, he said, no, we're not going to allow you to do that. I read the code differently. We've got the same code, but I'm interpreting it differently, okay? And you can't fork. And this is not just about your rights as states. It's about more profound human rights. And as a result, the community went into a massive battle, okay? The bloodiest battle in our history. Now, this photo is interesting for other reasons, though, too, because there's a lot of cyber dimensions that are reflected here. Does anyone recognize who this gentleman is on the left of President Lincoln? Exactly. Alan Pinkerton. And who was Alan Pinkerton? Secret Service. Alan Pinkerton at this time was running what was called the Union Intelligence Service. It was the precursor to the U.S. Secret Service. Okay? And it represented intelligence at that time. And he did multiple things. He supposedly invented the whole notion of cover, although I have to believe that was going on for several thousand years. But he had Pinkerton's detective service, and then when the war started, the president recruited him to not only do intelligence, but also to protect the president. And it was actually near this time that the president was in this photo that the president was almost killed. And Pinkerton discovered a plot and interrupted and blocked it right before it happened. Okay? And if you think Pinkerton's job was easy, just look at what happened when Pinkerton left. It was not long after the war, Pinkerton was told, you're done, we don't need these protective services anymore, and I think it was only within a few months that Lincoln was shot and killed. So this intelligence was valuable, and the security was very valuable that Pinkerton provided. In fact, you could see him glancing out over the plains like he's looking for the next, you know, intruder to come in and come after the president, whereas the general over there is respectfully looking right at the president. So Pinkerton's an interesting guy, very important in history, somewhat controversial. American labor unions would call him a definite black hat, okay? Because Pinkerton was involved in protecting companies against the union, and there was a lot of things that went on in those days. But Pinkerton was an important time, but he represents that column of activity that I'll call .IC, Intelligence Community Activities. The president, in many ways, represents .gov, or this primarily civilian activities. And then to the right, we have one other gentleman. Does anyone recognize this gentleman? McClernand. That's right. McClellan was another general. This is General McClernand, quite similar. Now, McClernand was an interesting guy. He's a brigadier general. Now, why is he here in this photo? Well, he's here in this photo because he was politically recruited by President Lincoln. Lincoln wanted to make sure that Illinois came with the side of the North in the war, and he recruited McClernand, who was a prominent Democrat in the state, who was very powerful in the south of that state, because he wanted to have that support. So McClernand is here, and some people said he wasn't that good of a general. In fact, he got dismissed in 1864 after losing a number of battles. But here in this photo, he's respectfully looking at Lincoln, who he had actually competed with a lot in his political career as well. But he represents .mil. So in this this magnificent photo here from 1862 at Antietam, we have .ic, .gov, and .mil. We got the three major constituent pieces of federal government networks that applies not only to our country, the United States of America, but to most countries around the world. And my job at the National Cybersecurity Center is to help foster collaboration and information sharing between those three constituencies, .ic, .gov, and .mil. And so this picture has a lot of meaning. But there's another piece here that's really significant, which is what new technology did Lincoln use in this war that had never been used in an American war before? Submarines is one. Telegraph. Okay, the telegraph became extremely important. They used to have messengers on horseback or runners moving messages. But with the spread of the railroad lines, the telegraph had taken off, and Lincoln was obsessed with the telegraph. If he were alive today, we'd probably call him an email junkie or a cyber junkie, okay? He was sending people back and forth to the Washington Telegraph office just constantly. And he said, this is taking too much time. We're bringing the telegraph here. So he brought it right into the War Office. And then he usually spent more time in the War Office than he did in the White House, all right? So because he was communicating directly with the generals, getting updates from the battlefield, what's going on, hearing what the strategy is, and giving his feedback. And, of course, there was then these wars. So, I mean, and also, so if we're going to call him a president, one thing I would call him is the first wired president, because it was a fixed wire, okay? And he was wired. He loved this stuff. He'd be down there at the War Office all the time. So what did the Confederates do, right? What do you do if the president's communicating with his generals on the telegraph lines? What do? You tap them or you clip them. Okay, so we had the first electronic activities going on related to warfare right at this period, literally starting in 1862. So there's a lot of meaning here, and I think it's much for us to digest. But what I'd like to do now is actually go back a little bit farther in history to see if we can get some lessons before we come back to the present. So let's go to the scene of another battlefield. And I wouldn't expect anyone to recognize this, but this crowd is so sharp, you might recognize it or put the pieces together. What do we see here? In the foreground, we see some American Indians, okay, with long rifles. But we also see some frontiersmen in fur caps. Those Indians are from various tribes. This scene is in western Pennsylvania. The frontiersmen are French. And who they're fighting are the redcoats in the middle of a road on their horses, and we can see some wagons there in the middle. Okay? This was the French and Indian Wars. As Britain sought to expand her realm in North America, she encountered the French, who also felt they had rightful claims there. And the Indians would often partner with one side or the other. Well, this battle had very great significance for our nation and potentially for cyber strategy as well. As you look at the redcoats there, you see an officer falling off a horse. Okay, the officers were moving around on horses, and the men were all in line formation on a road, okay, in a regular line formation, centrally planned, organized, and controlled, ready to, you know, fire their guns and fire their muskets. And these other guys, what's their formation? Right? No formation. It's guerrilla warfare. They're ducking, hiding, and weaving behind the trees, behind the rock, behind the mounds. So what happened in this battle? What do you think happened? Well, the Redcoats got annihilated, okay? The Redcoats just got slaughtered. I think the ratio was 25 or 30 to 1 in terms of deaths in this battle, okay? And why was this battle so important? The reason it was so important is the guy who's on the horse next to the one that's falling off is one of the only officers that survived this battle. He was 23 years old from Virginia, and his name was George Washington. Washington survived this battle, and what do you think he learned? He learned something about strategy, didn't he? He learned something about how we're going to fight wars or not fight wars. And that made him a much more flexible general. So when he took over as a commander-in-chief of the American Revolutionary Forces, he had two different game plans, right? He had a centralized game plan. Let's line up the men. Let's do traditional warfare and use traditional strategies. but he was also ready to use guerrilla tactics when necessary. And I think that that flexibility was key to the success of this tiny group of colonies in fighting with one of the greatest powers in the world at that day. And he gained great renown as a general and amazingly was never wounded in any of the battles that he was in. But success didn't come easy. In fact, the whole thing was almost lost. And why was the war almost lost? It was almost lost because of one of the same challenges we face today. And what's one of the greatest threats we face in cyber? Lack of resources is one, and that was a serious challenge. And that definitely was very heavy in this battle. Another thing was insider threats and hackers. Okay? So what was the insider threat that almost toppled this entire war? And here's the photo. Anyone recognize this man? Benedict Arnold, the fifth, correct. Benedict Arnold was one of the greatest commanders in the American Revolutionary Forces. Okay? He was stationed at West Point. He was running West Point. He'd done a phenomenal job, but he was a little bit bitter, and he had an attitude. Now, why was he bitter? Number one, he had been a fantastic commanding officer, but he was passed over for promotion multiple times. Two, he was in financial difficulties, and when that was discovered and a bit of an investigation was underway, he was charged with corruption, or people were saying that he was corrupt in how he'd handled things. And that, according to him, that was not true. Okay? And he fought that accusation strongly. He was furious about it. Okay? And he saw this war right on an edge. And it was like, well, the Americans could win or the Americans could lose. And what did he see? His opportunity. So he sold out for a price of 360 pounds a year for the rest of his life, and roughly 5,000 pounds up front. He sold all the plans to West Point and gave the British a whole plan for taking it over, and it was the central garrison of the U.S. Military resources at that time. And if it had fallen, and it would have, America would have lost the war. It was won, however, because another redcoat was detained, and they found on him all the plans that Benedict Arnold had written, as well as the layout and the blueprint for the fort and what was going to take place. So Benedict Arnold was the insider threat. And here we sit, you know, some 232 years later, roughly, and we have the same threats today, just on different technology and different medium. But we've talked a little bit about the history of wars and what they mean for strategy and how that may relate to cyber. Let's talk a little bit about system engineering. So Washington somehow and the revolutionaries somehow prevailed. They won eventually. Okay, they won the war. Then what? Right? The old operating system's gone. What are you going to do? Well, you could reboot, just put the same operating system back in, but they didn't want that. They didn't want monarchy. So question I have for you is, how did America re-engineer, and those founding fathers re-engineer democracy, which had been around for thousands of years? What was the system re-architecting that they did that has persisted until today? I'm sorry?
Team approach.
Okay. Definitely a candidate. I'm sorry? Balance of powers between the three, the executive, the judiciary, and the legislative.
Freedom BSD.
Well, you know we're getting on the topic, okay? So we're getting close here. The main thing, the main innovation, and the chief system engineer of this innovation was this man. I bet some of you went to a school named after him. Anyone recognize him? He's the least talked about founding father. I wouldn't expect you to know who he is. It's George Mason. George Mason was the father of the Virginia Bill of Rights in 1776. It was the first document of a government stating that individuals have rights. The British had a Bill of Rights, but it was the rights of Parliament versus the monarchy. Okay, it was the rights of a representative body and that government versus a monarchy. It was not the individual rights of you and me. Mason was the first person to say humans have rights, inalienable rights. And he drafted 19 of them in a Bill of Rights that was passed in Virginia in 1776. Okay, this is a fundamental new piece of system engineering. He defined a new class of entities, rights of individuals, and then he instantiated it with 19 instances of rights. okay? All of which survived into the American Bill of Rights. Now, he cared so much about system architecture. Guess what he did at the Constitutional Convention when they didn't include the Bill of Rights? He boycotted it, or he refused to sign the U.S. Constitution that he helped shape form, because he said, if there's no individual rights here, we're not done. We're not doing the right thing. So he stood out for four more years like an inveterate system engineer or architect who's not getting his way with something that he knows is right in design. He kept slamming his fist on the table. 4 years after the U.S. Constitution was approved in 1787, in 1791, the Bill of Rights was approved by the United States of America. That Bill of Rights, which is very similar to what he had written, is now extant in almost 160 countries around the world and has helped to create that balance that we have in society between our rights as citizens and the rights of the country and the nation. And clearly, as we move into the world of cyber, it's more important than ever that we have that foundation and we have that balance of the individual rights versus the state's rights and other parties that are in our society. So a big salute to George Mason as a system engineer. So his open source module one, okay, that new module with those entities called individual rights spread in the code throughout the world. And I would argue is the most significant contribution of America from a constitutional standpoint to the world. So let's look at our challenge today, right? We got this huge cyber challenge. I mean, this is not easy. Does anyone think this is easy? Well, it's maybe easy to hack into things. Does anyone think it's easy to do this security? Okay, right, it's tough. It's really tough. So how are we going to do it? Well, the only thing I know is to refer back to Bill Sharpe's words, all of us are smarter than any of us. So I think we've got to figure out how we're going to collaborate on our efforts. We have to figure out how we collaborate in evolving the system, in changing the rules, in changing our practices, in inoculating the system, and all the many different strategies. But we've really got to figure out how to work together better. Now, at the highest level, I think there's really a couple simple questions we want to ask ourselves. And that is, where do we want to go with the system? Okay? We know we're trying to fight security breaches and problems today, but I mean, where do we want this system to be in 20 years? What do we want it to look like? What do we want society to look like that's being glued together or linked together inextricably, incredibly, in complex fashions in a web with this technology? Where do we want to go, and what's the end state that we seek? And we need to have that discussion, and we need to think about those issues, because if we don't define the end state, where are we going to go? If we don't define the end state, we're going to keep evolving or twittering or moving and wiggling and going in different directions. But I think we do want to think as a society, globally, as well as nationally, and where we want to go with this system. There's only one problem, I would argue. We don't know the rules. We do not know the rules. I think we're a lot like the alchemists that were melting metals over fires and mixing and creating alloys and trying to figure out which ones were strong, but they didn't have the elemental table of chemistry. So they couldn't engineer it. They couldn't really understand it. They could observe and they could react. I would argue that we have this problem in cyber. Let's step into some of those problems and the repercussions. To highlight the challenges that we face and how we don't know all the rules, this is a basketball scoreboard. It kind of looks like a high-scoring game, right? It's not over yet, and it's 113-99. Looks like a high-scoring game. But if this were cyber, what would the score be? I would argue the score would be 113 million to 99 million. Why? Because offense is so much easier than defense. So much easier than defense. And that's a fundamental challenge that we face. What are some of those rules we don't understand? Number one, the physics of networking. Okay? If you look at chips, right, we have Moore's Law. And Moore's Law says every 18 months the computing power of a chip, the processing speed, doubles. Right? And somehow it's held true for 35 years. Okay? Well, what's the rate of increase in bandwidth? Some people tell me it's 100% a year compounding. Other people tell me it's 300%. You know, there's smart people in the audience like Marcus Sachs. He could probably tell me, you know, what the numbers, but I don't think we have a law, We don't have a law to even realize or know how fast the bandwidth is moving or how exactly to define that. Secondly, we don't know how to value networks, right? When you ask someone the question of how valuable is a network, what law do we refer to, or what's the power of a network? We talk about Metcalfe's law. And what does Metcalfe's law say? It says the power of the network is equal to the square of the number of nodes or hosts connected. Okay? Well, there's only one problem with the law. Well, there's a couple problems with the law. Number one, it's not a law. Okay, it's not true. Right? The fax network is bigger today than it ever was, but it's much less valuable and powerful because it's been substituted by email and by FedEx and many other things. Okay? So Metcalfe's law is not really a law. It's a useful insight, and I have complete reverence and respect for Metcalfe as the father of Ethernet and many very important technologies that contribute to our modern age. Truly a networking genius. But Metcalfe's law is not a law that we build our systems on, right? Have you ever used that computation in some security thing you've done? I don't think so, okay? So what are the economics of networks? What are the economics of security? How much should your company really invest in security? How much should the government invest in security? Are open questions. And we have to have these economic models, or how do we do risk management? I mean, we can do anecdotal risk management, okay, and we can do a little bit of intuitive risk management, but rigorous risk management, as practiced in most fields, whether that's insurance or finance or like the area I came from in derivatives trading, is very statistically robust work with a lot of computing power, a lot of stochastics, a lot of Monte Carlo simulations, a lot of calculus. And we have a lot of statistics that you've developed in, you know, net flow analysis and other activities on the network to detect things, but I'd argue without the economics, we don't have a risk management function in terms of our investments in security. So we have work to do. We have fundamental work to do. So now I'm jumping off the cliff here. If I wasn't jumping off the black hat cliff far enough already, I'm going to jump off the cliff here. I want to share some concepts, some ideas under development on what might be some pieces for looking at the economics of security. I'm actually doing some work right now on developing models for the economics of networks to answer the question, the simple question of how valuable is a network? How valuable is a network? And what's the correlation and relationship of values across different networks, whether that's the internet, the telephone network, or VoIP network, POTS network, different networks. And we need to understand this to drive some of the re-architecting of our system. So let's take a stab at trying to put together some economics. I would argue that, because in risk management, there's a function we want to get at usually that we want to maximize or minimize, or multiple functions. Okay? In financial risk management, we're trying to figure out what the value of a portfolio is, what the real liquidity value is, and what the standard deviation is, or what we call the value at risk around that, and then the shape of the distribution. You know, is it like a bell curve, or is it more leptokurtotic? What does that distribution look like? At a high level, I'd argue that in security, what we want to look at is we want to minimize C, which is our cost, total cost, where C is simply the aggregation or adding the total security cost of all security and all expected losses. So security is a cost as well as the losses are a cost. And then I reflect on this because I hear many people come and saying, Rod, you know, the government should do more, you know, with the banking sector because they're not doing enough on risk management because, you know, things keep happening. And I say, you know what? The banking segment in general, it tends towards rationality because they manage risk every day in their loan portfolio and this and that. And we see systemic issues like we see now with the subprime issue. But over time and overall, it's a pretty rational business process. So I say the banks are probably doing a pretty good job of estimating what their losses are and then figuring out how much security investment they can make to reduce that. Now, this is a very simple framework, but what are some of the repercussions of it if we try to step forward? So then I said, well, what we want to try to figure out is what's the loss function and what's the security function? And I'm sure it's different for every one of your companies or every one of your customers or your groups or your organizations, but I took a stab at it. So here's a chart where we have lost dollars spent in terms of lost on the vertical axis and a security investment on the horizontal axis. And what I try to do is a lot of people tell me, they say, you know, the first 80% of security is really easy, right? Just install the, you know, buy relatively new devices or have current devices, have your patches installed, have your, whether it's their firewalls, your NetFlow monitors, your different, all your different software up to date, you'll stop 80% of the attacks. So you get a pretty good return, right, for your first investment security. So if we look at this diagram here, we see a big drop in losses with that first investment of security as you work across. And the loss level I have limited here only because theoretically there's a limit to how much loss you can have as an organization, and that's your total value. You know, you can't lose more than you're worth, or you can't lose more than the whole economy, you know, in the case of the United States. So there's a cap on losses. And then it comes down, but then we know as you tighten up your security, right, and this is what I'm taking this from like the wisdom of crowds, and we need to collectively define these curves and move them around. But I'm just trying to explain why I shaped this one like I did. But the security dollars keep going up. You get a marginal payoff, right? You'll start spending $10 to maybe save $1 in losses at some point, only because the best hackers, the toughest hackers, still know how to get through. Or they'll use the insider technique, you know, and potentially buy someone off. So I'm not saying this is the exact shape of the curve, but this is a conceptual model to think about where we're going. And then the question becomes, so what's our optimum investment level? Because I had breakfast this morning with some CISOs of very large corporations, and we were talking about how their organizations choose their level of investment. And I don't think it's really based upon estimated losses. It's more the process of budgeting, and the CIO gets so much, and then a little bit's going to go to the CISO here, or maybe we'll charge all the desktop users for their antivirus software, and we'll charge other people for network services. But it's sort of kind of a bootstrap model. It's not really based on analyzing it. So if it's true we're trying to minimize C equals S plus L, how do we figure out where on that green line we want to be? And I don't know, but I'm going to make a proposal. Again, this is a conceptual framework, and it's for you to chew apart and share back and improve and help develop. But I'm going to argue that the optimum solution is where a dollar spent on security reduces a dollar of loss, so the slope is at a 45-degree angle. And where that angle hits this curve, and there may be multiple instances of that, but let's assume that usually there's one, where that dollar hits the curve is the point that we should be investing. So in here, if we follow the dotted line down to the bottom in security, there's a number of dollars there that should represent, that should be the optimal level that we're investing. Okay, given a function that we think we understand, because right, you know, because we can also say, you know, how do you figure out this curve? I mean, how are you ever going to get this data? Can we really know this much to plot it? No, not exactly, but guess what? Through our behavior, we're defining that curve in some sense. Through the dollars that are spent in our organizations, whether it's the federal government or whether it's Boeing or whether it's Verizon or AT&T or any of your company, BT, any company around the world, we're defining where we think that is by our behavior or where we're assuming that is. So that's just high level. So economics, I think, but we need to do a lot more work in this area, I think, to have the models to move forward. Now, one of the economics I'm really interested in, or the leverage points, is to look at the protocols, right? Because, I mean, just look at what's going on right now. And a lot of you, how many people in the room are working on fixing the DNS hole right now or somehow involved with that problem? Okay? Huge problem, right? Because as the world, as we all get super connected with more and more devices, more phones, more indicators, more GPSs, as everything gets connected, more SCADA systems, more train lines, more chemical plants, they're all going IP, it's great, right? Because it's all interconnected. But it's also more vulnerable. We're enhancing our vulnerability. And what we're creating is a single point of failure in our system, in our social system, in our communication system, in our economic system. And that single point of failure is the IP protocols, particularly some of the core protocols, such as BGP, DNS, and I'm going to refer to some others in a moment here that are not IP protocols, but which are related as other networks. So why do we want to invest in protocols? We want to invest in the protocols because it may be the cheapest security dollars that we can invest. In fact, and here I'm going to blow the DHS horn a bit, but our secretary has been very supportive of investments in this area. And I don't know how many people here know Doug Maughan and the Science and Technology Group at DHS under Admiral Cohen's leadership, but they're doing the primary funding of research right now for DNSSEC and also for enhancing BGP, Border Gateway Protocol. Now, these are long-term, important, underlying things that don't take that much money to move forward, but we've got to move forward because we've got to change the odds of this game. Okay? Now, let me talk about SMS and IP for a second because it's a passion of mine. But I happened to be in New York when 9/11 hit. Okay, it was a very traumatic experience, extremely emotional experience, and it changed my life. Okay, my wife was actually booked on Flight 93 that day. It was a ticket we had purchased, and we changed that about 10 days before 9/11, so she was taking a later flight, which is why she's alive today and will join me here on Saturday. But 9/11 was a very intense day, and what I learned being there in New York was, you know, the Verizon Towers, other towers went down that were on top of the two great towers. You couldn't use your cell phone. You just couldn't get out. Okay? So you had millions of people who couldn't commute with the product they had in their hands. But something did work, and that was texting. And I also happened to be in Pakistan when the earthquake hit. I had just left Islamabad 14 hours before, and I was in the south in Karachi when the quake hit. And I studied that incident. And I studied the tsunami and Katrina, and there's only one device that's worked for citizens when everything else went down, and that's text messages. Text messages use a different radio frequency, goes 7 miles instead of 3.5, and it's very low bandwidth, right? Only like 140 characters, so those messages get through. A cell phone tower can handle maybe 100 to 200 calls simultaneously. It can handle 5,000 text messages a second. Okay? So when bad things happen, text messages become critical to help people stay alive, to communicate, to coordinate their efforts. Now, what's the problem with our SMS system and our architecture? One of them is there are IP dependencies between the SMS servers and the telco. So inside the telco, things are pretty good. And some of the peering relationships don't use the IP protocols. They use direct peering technology. But there's IP in the system. Because there's IP in the system, if IP goes down, what happens? Texting could go down in part. So we need to look at that. We need to look at how we make that kind of network resilience, the kind of investments that I think that we want to look at making in POTS. You know, we all sneer at POTS, right? Plain old telephone system, circuit switch, copper wires, dinosaurs, right? That's from like Lincoln's time. Well, guess what? If IP goes down, if DNS goes down, if BGP goes down, what are you going to use to communicate? What are you going to use to communicate? Can't do email, you can't surf, you can't browse. A lot of the communication systems are going to be down. A lot of industrial systems are going to be down. Those plain old telephones are going to become pretty darn precious. And so we want to look at also keeping some other protocols alive, and what does it take us to do that? Now, what's the economics of protocols? So let's say that we can enhance BGP and DNS and others. What we do is we move the line down, the loss line, right? If we tighten up the protocols, if we make it harder for hackers systemically in how we design the internet and other networks, we actually move the loss line down. So we don't have to invest as much money to get to a given level of protection for our assets and for society. What are the economics of privacy? Okay, as Andrew mentioned, I was chairman of a privacy company for 2.5 years. We worked together with American Express and First Data Systems, who were investors in the country. And what we did is we developed anonymous private credit cards that complied with law enforcement edicts. So in other words, you were guaranteed anonymity in your online surfing and your transactions and your shipping as long as it was legal. If it was illegal and a warrant or subpoena was delivered, then your identity could be presented. But otherwise, it was a very, very tight system. And learned a lot through that. And one of the challenges we have in society is to figure out where do we go with that balance, right? Because we have to find a balance between convenience and these privacy and security measures. But I think we have an education challenge, and one that you in this room can help with. And what's that education challenge? That education challenge is that we can have more privacy and still have security. Security for law enforcement and security for other activities. And we've got to increase that knowledge and share that knowledge so that we can get to the kind of system that that people feel have the right set of balances. And you know, we're wiggling around that, but I think that your role in that is extremely, extremely important. And I just spent a few days with some leading thinkers in this area from the privacy groups just to hear their perspective. And they have a perspective, but I think we need to hear that perspective and see how we can improve the systems, but at the same time, have law and order in our society. And balancing those is really important, and I think getting to a healthy debate. Let's talk a little bit about some of the new frontiers that I think we want to develop and can develop. One, cyber democracy, right? We already see this with blogging, right? The great use of our First Amendment rights are spreading like crazy as bloggers all over the world. And we've got concerns about, you know, polling in America and how do you have controls. But the reality is we could move over the coming decades significantly towards more automated voting and polling online. And where's it going to take us? How about governance? How are we running our government systems? And what can we learn from the cyber efforts and from Web 2.0 and collaboration technologies to get to become even more productive? And this was a great week for us. Secretary Chertoff came to Silicon Valley, and we had a lot of very interesting meeting with tech leaders, not only from the security realm, but also from Web 2.0 and online social networking realms, to just understand what's going on there and what can we learn and how can we support good efforts there and how can that support us. Cyber quarantines, right? What happens? Everyone remembers SARS, right? SARS is horrible, you know, shut down travel largely. What happened if you showed up in an airport and you had 106-degree temperature and you showed the characteristics of SARS? You got quarantine, right? You got pulled aside. We're going to quarantine you until this is out of your body. Well, if we can quarantine human bodies, why can't we quarantine computers that are disrupting the Internet? And what are the laws we need to do to be able to develop to be able to do that? Or what are the business practices and what are the alliances? I think are interesting questions. Another question is cyber justice. You know, how do we become even more effective in law enforcement? Like this week was great too. We had a major announcement of this ID theft ring being busted that had 40 million credit card records. Okay, 11 people all around the world, I think 4 or 5 different countries. And justice is going to be brought to those people. But how can we use cyber itself to bring more justice to the system, to punish those that are taking advantage of society? And finally, a passion for me is cyber diplomacy. You know, where do we go internationally? So on that one, I want to step through another model, another mental model to throw out. How many people here have heard of The Prisoner's Dilemma? I heard it just came out in a recent movie, too. A movie just came out, and they had the Prisoner's Dilemma story. So the Prisoner's Dilemma was developed in 1950 by two researchers at Rand Corporation. And they said, imagine a scene where a crime has been committed. The police come to the scene. They see two people fleeing in different directions. They apprehend these two men. They put them in separate cells, and they're going to interrogate them. And here are the rules. They both stay silent. And they cooperate, they'll get 1 year each. There's enough evidence, they'll get 1 year each. But if one of them will compromise the other, and the other doesn't compromise them, the one who's compromised gets 5 years, the one who shared the information is free. But if they both compromise each other, they both get 3 years. So 3 and 3. So in the first outcome, if they both stay silent, it's 1 year, and 1 year is 2 years. Okay. If one of them compromises the other, it's 5 years. They both compromise each other's 6 years total prison time. Now, if you're in that individual cell and you have no other relationship with that party, where are you going to go with this? Where are you going to take this? And what they found in The Prisoner's Dilemma is it moves to the lose-lose box. It moves to the worst equation because both parties in their self-interest will compromise the other. Because if the other hasn't compromised them, then they get off free. And if the other has compromised them, then they only get 3 years instead of five. So if we act selfishly in this game, which prisoner will do in this situation, you get to the lose-lose box. Okay, and that's interesting. It becomes more interesting when you play the game 200 times, which is what Professor Axelrod came up with. So he said, what happens if we take this 200 times and invite the smartest people in the world to do programs to compete with each other in the prisoner's dilemma? What are we going to come up with? And what they found is that the system moved towards cooperation. Because if you had a program that's going to compete with the other and you want to have wins, if the other one, if you keep violating each other, you're just going to end up in that lose-lose box. So what he found out was it was an amazing outcome. There were multiple Nobel Prize winners submitted models, mathematicians, ethicists, computer scientists. Does anyone remember what model won against all models in the world? The simplest model possible. Tit for tat, exactly. Starting with cooperating, the golden rule. So the strategy that worked better than any other strategy against every computer model that was created was to cooperate in the first move, do the golden rule, and then tit for tat everyone after that. Now, this is important. Why is this important? Imagine the Internet with a two-state scenario. Imagine a superpower in the West and maybe a superpower in the East. Or pick your choice of two nations. The question I've asked many people is, and many cyber experts, is which box do you think that we're in? Which box are we in? And many say they feel that we're in a lose-lose box. And some feel that we're in a win-lose or a lose-win. Most people say we're in a lose-lose box. So what can we learn from the prisoner's dilemma? And I'd say what we can learn from the prisoner's dilemma is that the path out of this is to figure out how to work in collaboration and to develop and explore those strategies to change and move the system. Because eventually, I think we all want to be in that win-win box, right? Especially when you consider the lose-lose box and the intellectual capital and resources that this country has and is generating on a daily and weekly basis, we have an awful lot to lose. So there's a lot of implications here for how we relate to the world. And if I summarize that, I would use this quote from Latin that many of you recognize, the original motto of our country. And can someone help me with the words here, the Latin? Out of many, one. Okay, out of many, one was the motto. Out of many states, one country. And in the internet now, what we're looking at is out of many countries and out of many peoples and out of many constituencies, how do we pull this the one together? So in summary, I think that what we're looking at nationally is, you know, what is the constitutional code that this nation's developed on? And we know that. Okay? And then how do we interpret and use that to be most effective in what we do? What are the new cyber rules that we need to understand or develop? What are the new economics? What are the new protocols? Where do we need to drive these networks and systems towards more security and resilience to make our jobs easier on a day-to-day basis? How do we develop the international framework? And how do we move towards cooperation? So in summary, I think the question for us is where do we want to plant our flag in cyberspace? Not only for America, but really for all countries in the world. And thank you very much for this opportunity, and I would be happy to take a few questions if we have time remaining. Thank you. I got two questions. There's a microphone somewhere, I think. And I'm trying to look back there without getting blinded. And if there's no questions, that's fine. Thank you very much. Great.